the isms, kism game, dine and go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. What you gonna
listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Are you tired of too many reruns on your Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
Africa Live. Africa Live. Africa Live. Africa Live. Africa Live. Africa Live.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Okay.
Uhuru, brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of Africa Live here on Uhuru Radio. I'm Amale Ishitela, chairman of the African Socialist International. I'm hosting today's show. On the first segment of today's show, we will revisit Newtown, Connecticut, the small town in the east coast of the United States that has come to world notoriety because of the December 14 massacre that took the lives of 28 people, that included 20 children between the ages of 5 and 7 years old, 6 women teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School, the site of the shooting, as well as 20-year-old Adam Lanza, the alleged shooter, and his mother, Nancy Lanza. You will remember that last Sunday, 2 days before the Newtown massacre, 2 days after, rather, the Newtown massacre, we dedicated the entire show to the discussion of Newtown. This was an event that sent shockwaves throughout the United States and other parts of the world and clearly demanded the kind of attention that we gave to it on last Sunday. However, 2 weeks later, in the wake of a series of funerals, I think the last of which are happening on today, the United States is still engaged in a national mourning of the victims of Newtown that, oddly enough, in many cases, include the alleged shooter himself, whom we are told, against all public evidence, suffered a mental illness. To get a better analysis of Newtown, we're going to be talking to two veterans of our movement. But before that, I just to give you a sense of how this question is being treated. Within the United States, in Alabama, Colorado, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Washington, D.C., Wyoming, to name just a few of the states, there have been all kinds of ceremonies and memorials and remembrances and other things happening in the wake of this shooting. In the state of Florida, there have been instances where school officials have brought guards to the schools as a demonstration to the families here that the schools are going to be secure at least for the days of the demonstration. And in Liberia, in West Africa, that has suffered incredible history of terror. 20 children from a school that is sponsored by the Newtown Rotary Club gathered at the United States Embassy to give their condolences. And each of the child from the Caroline Miller School, which sounds extraordinarily African, in Monrovia placed a flower on a poster bearing the name of a victim of the shooting. And this is in Liberia. I don't remember ever seeing such a demonstration of concern in this country for the numbers of Africans who were killed and in extraordinary ways in Liberia itself. And then, of course, we've read that in the Sandy Hook shooting, that the town that is in mourning is inundated with gifts and money. Money, toys, food, and other gifts have poured in from around the world as Newtown, Connecticut mourns the loss of 20 children and 6 employees at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And this is in Yahoo News on the Internet. And, of course, probably all of our listeners are aware of the fact that Newtown has a median income that is 74% higher than most of the cities in the United States. We've also seen that that not only did the Newtown community benefit from such an outpouring of gifts and well wishes, but Barack Hussein Obama has received his highest approval rating in the wake of this shooting than he had seen since 2009. So he received a 56% approval rating between December 17th and 19th. And this, like I said, this was the biggest, the highest three-day rating since October 2009 that Obama has experienced. We've seen also that Louis Farrakhan, who is the head of the Nation of Islam, issued a statement on the Newtown massacre that we'll reference later on in this discussion. So this is clearly an indication of the kind of concern that's happening here in the United States around the Newtown massacre that helps us to believe that it's important to continue this discussion because, as you know, there's now a new push for gun control. We've seen Obama indicating that he's really going to do something with gun control issue. Joe Biden, Obama's president, vice president, the guy who was able to support Obama for election because he was clean and he didn't talk like the rest of the black people unless he actually wanted to do so, has been handed the responsibility of organizing this response to the mourning and outpouring and outrage by many, 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 many liberals about the accessibility of guns in this country. So we want to get a better analysis of Newtown. We want to get a better understanding of what in the world is going on. We've heard that the Newtown is an indication of also a need of better mental health in this country and better attention to the issue of mental health. Adam Lanza has been described again against all public evidence to support it as someone who is in severe need of mental health, and this has been put forth as probable cause of the killings, the massacres of those babies and women in Newtown, Connecticut. So we're talking to two people here on today who spent most of their lives investigating and analyzing United States and capitalist society for the purpose of overturning the social system around which all of its activities revolve. Penny Hess is the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee. She's here in the studio with us today. And she has spent more than 30 years in the ranks of the Uhuru movement, working in New York, Maine, Kentucky, California, Florida, you name it. Omawalla K. Fing has been a member of the Uhuru movement for almost 40 years. He is a former editor of the Burning Spear newspaper and the Central Committee of the and a member of the Central Committee of the African People's Socialist Party, United States. And there are very few places in the United States that K. Fing has not worked as an organizer for the liberation of Africa and African people and the creation of a united socialist African. And I want Africa. And I want to welcome both of you, K. Fing, Penny Hess, to Africa Live. And hopefully, as a consequence of this discussion with the two of you, we can get a better understanding of the meaning of the Newtown massacre and a better understanding of the responses that we are having from throughout the country and in places like Liberia where the Newtown has stretched his arms out and had some little children there come to say how sympathetic they are for the affluent dead in Newtown, Connecticut. So why don't we get with it and see Is the problem gun control? Is the problem mental health? What are the real bases of the contradiction that we're looking at with the Newtown massacre and, of course, the subsequent and even prior killings that we've seen happening on campuses and public places in the United States over the last few years? Kay-Fing, what you think?
Uhuru, Chairman O'Malley, and Penny, and Uhuru Radio's listening audience, I think that in order to have any kind of clarity on what happened in Newtown, the starting point has got to be that what they call Newtown now was, you know, back in 1700s, full of Native people. And right now, the Native population in Newtown is 0.12%. Now, just what that is, I don't know. But I do know that that has got to be the starting point, that the population now is a settler, white colonial population whose wealth is built off the very capitalism that this party, this movement in the world revolution is trying to overturn. And until that recognition is made, then of course there will be no peace in Newtown or anywhere else. And you're correct, Kevin. They're coming up with all kinds of ideas on what the problem is that brought about Newtown. One editorial, one opinion page, this woman, Kathleen Parker, is talking about, turn off your televisions, you know, and just be quiet for a while. Eric Holder's even going down, making all kind of gun control announcements, like as if gun manufacturers and U.S. imperialism are not the biggest, you know, gun runners on the planet, and ain't nothing Holder or anybody else going to do to stop that other than the people's revolution. We got a problem here that's being absolutely the starting point as far as ruling class media is concerned, comes nowhere close to solving the problem. Again, I think that our starting point has got to be what they did to the Native people that used to populate Newtown. And then the point you raised, Chairman O'Malley, on last Sunday's segment of Africa Live, the victims of the children in Newtown even have the ability to cry for the people in Somalia who are being drowned, for the people in Afghanistan who are being drowned. And that's a critical question. But not only that, I watched a documentary on the Bloods and the Crips and the black mothers who were crying and weeping, you know, over their children. But none of their children were deemed to be worthy of memorials. None of their children, you know, and we saw that none of the shooters were insane or crazy, you know, but what they did have for the shooters and the non-shooters and the illegal drug economy that they put them in was, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, especially in California, putting billions of dollars into more prisons. So I think that all of these points has got to be investigated before we can even come close to coming up with an analysis of what happened in Newtown.
Uhuru. You're listening to Africa Live. This is O'Malley Ishatello. I'm your host on today. You're listening to Uhuru Radio, We are glad to have you with us, and we're talking with Omawale K. Fing, who is in Houston, Texas, by phone. And here in the studio is Comrade Penny Hess, who is the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee. You may want to join this discussion, and if so, you can call within the United States to put in your say, which is more than you get an opportunity to do most instances in this country around any critical question. The phone number within the United States to call is 727-565-1599. That's 727-565-1599. If you're calling from the United Kingdom, the country code is 44, then 020-8133-6629. That's 44020-8133-6629. Our Skype ID, should you want to Skype us, is Uhuru Radio. Our email address is dj@uhururadio.com. There may be some of you who have friends who cannot access us by internet, but you may be able to call them because they can call and listen to us in the United States. They can call at 425-905-1825. That's 425-905-1825. In the United Kingdom, the number to call to listen by phone is 020-3051-7985. In Cape Town, it is 21-673-6887. And in Johannesburg, it is 11-287-2287. Thank you very much. And now let's get back to our discussion around the Newtown issue. And Kay-Fing, just a bit of a follow-up on your comments. Jamie Foxx, who has just released a new movement, A Wash in Blood and Gore, I'm told, has also had his two cents to put in terms of how television and media, movies and that kind of thing have an impact, he is sure, on the violence that we see happening in this country. And Minister Louis Farrakhan has released a statement on the Newtown Massacre. I'd just like to read it. It's really short. He says that it is terrible to witness what we just witnessed in the slayings of these children. Every life has a purpose. Innocent life is more valuable in the sight of God. So when innocent life is sacrificed, what lessons should we learn from such a tremendous sacrifice, tremendous suffering, tremendous pain? Why should our president, a father, shed tears over the precious lives that were torn away from their parents and friends? Is to help a nation see that guns and the weapons of war cannot bring about the joy, happiness, and peace that was robbed from the people of Newtown. And hopefully, the President of the United States, sending more drones into Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, and other places, killing men, women, and children, and the world says collateral damage, and we go on killing. Could it be that these precious lives lost and the pain that it has caused every one of us who shares the pain of those parents and those loved ones who lost those precious children and the lives of the teachers who taught them? Could it be that God wants us to see then that until you can feel the pain and suffering of others that has been inflicted upon them on the basis of a lie and America's reach for the resources of the areas of the world, then maybe you will understand that this may be the quote-unquote chickens coming home to roost. For as thou hast done, the book says, so shall it be done unto you. Minister, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, servant to the lost found Nation of Islam in the West. This is from The Final Call. Kay-Fing, so what do you think about that statement?
Well, in the first place, I think that Again, it takes a condemnation of capitalism And in the first place, you know, it came from the whole lost and found nation of Islam, because Malcolm taught us that the first thing that we have to understand is that we are not Americans. You know, therefore, any president of the United States is not our president. It seems to me that what the statement is basically saying is making African people an accomplice in what it is that that this country is doing around the world. It legitimizes the U.S. government not only as being legal, having legal authority over African people, and legal authority to actually drone the people of the world. So, in terms of this statement being able to offer a remedy to the problem, I don't think it comes nowhere close. I think that the truth should be told. I don't know. I think we camouflage the issue when we say God has something to do with it, because clearly the imperialists needed this. You know, this whole setup is an imperialist setup. God had nothing to do with this. So, again, you know, in order for us to get to the truth, in order for us to make struggle, to make revolution, the question is, do we tell the truth? You know, do we, again, you know, Mr. Farrakhan know that that white population in Newtown, which is nothing but a suburb of New York City, where wealth has been accumulated for the past 2-3 centuries, you know, that, you know, again, none of us agree with the random murder of children. But let's put it into some perspective. You know, we've got 6 million dead in Congo, no tears, nowhere. Power children there, you know. No call for gun control, you know, which is absolute nonsense, even, you know. No call for gun control. They don't want nobody to have guns but the state. Seems like that's a call that Mr. Farrakhan is making also. So, now, I mean, we got to deep into the question. We can't be slick side, you know, accomplices on this question. We have to, you know, to straight up define capitalism as the enemy, and no such thing as, you know, that we must keep always, like the old Black Panther Party slogan, arm yourself or harm yourself, you know. So that's my take on that statement.
So you're saying that this this statement of our president is something like Malcolm X is talking about, we sick, you know, it's the similar kind of characterization that Malcolm made in terms of uniting with the United States, you know, like our astronauts, our president, right? And it's really interesting that he should use the terms the chickens coming home to roost here, because it's exactly the statement that Malcolm X made about a president, John F. Kennedy, when he was assassinated, that resulted in the process that led, that allowed Louis X to become Louis Farrakhan.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
You know, we just did a thing on the election, and by the way, you know, I think Arizona just made a demand that more than 60 million people be made mandatory put on the rolls of the voter registration. But listen, like we raised in the, I think you raised it 3 or 4 years ago, Chairman, at the presentation that you made here in Houston, Texas, about the black power in the era of Barack Obama, at the point where our people were paused to at least look at revolutionary organizations as alternatives. We've got to almost reinvent the wheel in terms of what Malcolm said about the Democratic Party, Republican Party, and we, our party, raising all the time, no confidence in the United States government, black or white, male or Republican, you know. So this whole struggle, Malcolm We've had that understanding for over 60 years. And when we, and Malcolm never said our we, so what Farrakhan has done, he's seemed to me being an accomplice in bringing our people back into the safe embrace of the Democratic Party.
Uh-huh.
You know, we remember in 1980, 79 or 80, gentlemen, we had the demonstration in Gainesville, Florida, when the revolutionary students in Iran had captured what they call, defined and what we united with them as, they captured U.S. Embassy, and they said was a nest of spies, a den of spies. Well, in that instance, they let all the Africans go, except I think one silly Marine wouldn't leave because he thought he was an American. Same thing in occupied Palestine. I think it might have been Lebanon when Lieutenant Goodman, an African, was caught massacring the Palestinian people. But the people in Lebanon had enough sense to know that African people didn't have nothing to do with him being in that plane, that he was just an unconscious, you know, African on a fool's mission. So that they let Goodman go too. So the world understood that African people are not, you know, don't have any power. They understand history, that it is imperialism and capitalism and exploited are white Europeans. So they let the Africans go. But now here we are, they put an African face on U.S. imperialist power, and this statement by Farrakhan, we, our president, that does nothing but justify to the world that African people now are in cahoots with U.S. imperialism. Let me say this one other thing. When Malcolm talked about the house Negro in the field Negro, what Barack Obama and Farrakhan is attempting to do is make the whole African population inside U.S. borders the house Negroes of the world. Mm-hmm. And we refuse to do that. And that won't work. Our people has always been internationalist people from Garvey on. You know, so Desalines and Toussaint down in Haiti. We've had the international spirit, so, and we are not collaborators. And our movement, I think that was God who said, sometimes, you know, when all else fails, conditions will make this thing right, you know, for us to organize our people. So, despite what Farrakhan and any others of the black PV do, petty bourgeoisie do, the African Revolution will prevail.
Uhuru. Uhuru. Comrade Pinhas, well, we've seen now, I'm sure, that the market for mental health counseling has probably expanded, and if it has any kind of industry on the stock market, it will help to relieve some anxiety of stockbrokers, because the stocks will probably go up on that. I've seen they've sent dogs into, special dogs into Newtown to help people with cuddling and feel cuddly and counsel, help to counsel them. There is a real serious issue here. And but some of us have been saying all along that in many ways what we're looking at with Newtown and many other kinds of shooting is the crisis of imperialism sort of turned inwardly, that this is, in fact, the crisis of imperialism. And then we learn that the guns used to kill those people were guns purchased by his mother, Nancy Lanza, who is a prepper. And I would not be surprised if there were a lot of preppers in Newtown. Because of what many of the preppers do is they move from the large metropolitan areas out to smaller areas because they assume that that's where doomsday is going to come. And a prepper, by the way, for those of you who may be unfamiliar with the concept, is a part of a growing number of individuals within the United States who, seeing the crisis on the horizon, economic crisis, some of them expect to be an actual collapse of the economy. Some of them anticipate nuclear war. Some of them are thinking of earthquakes, and they do all of this stuff to prepare. And those who see anarchy descending upon the country, buying guns and storing foods and other stuff of that nature, and Nancy Lanza, in anticipation of the crisis of imperialism, has purchased these guns, I guess without any expectation that the crisis of imperialism would step right into her house from the inside. What do you think? What's going on?
Uhuru Chairman, Uhuru. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to the show today, and I want to salute Omowale K. Fing as well. It's definitely the crisis of imperialism, and one of the things that really strikes me is that, generally speaking, white people in the U.S. and maybe in Europe are the only people in the world, really, when you think about it, whose children, and they're not raising their children, and the children are not growing up under the threat almost daily of U.S. war, U.S. bombs, U.S. drones, or sanctions that starved to death 650,000 children in Iraq under the Clinton administration, you know, that, or just plain starvation because of the rape of Africa and other places, death in childbirth, all of the violence against children that comes down under the colonial domination by the U.S. imperialism of the world. And this is the crisis of imperialism. It is just, you know, it turning, white people turning in on their own society. And they talk about assault rifles, assault weapons, which the U.S. government is the greatest perpetrator of the violence and certainly seller and puts assault weapons all around the world, including in this country, in the African community. It's Eric Holder has just been exposed in the last year or so in that Fast and Furious. How many assault weapons did he put into Mexico? Was he responsible for thousands? You know, this violence is perpetrated by U.S. imperialism, and it's turning in on itself. And the thing is that it wasn't necessary to have assault weapons to do what white people did at Sand Creek in Colorado, where the majority children, babies, and mothers were tortured and assaulted by U.S. volunteer soldiers in the 1800s, where they held down the women while they took their babies and bounced them around on their bayonets, passing them back and forth like some kind of game, holding the mothers down. It was happening right in front of them, then slaughtering the mothers, cutting out their vaginas, their uteruses, and using them as souvenirs and hat bands. And this is the history of the U.S. Nobody talks about the 10,000 homes burned down, not an assault rifle to be found in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 1920s. When 10,000 houses were burnt down, 39 people were officially killed, although Africans say 300 people killed, and thousands of African children left homeless, orphaned in that situation, traumatized. There was no trauma team to deal with them. There was no question of the mental illness or mental sanity of the white people that did that. You know, the whole Rosewood, all the African children affected by the U.S. counterinsurgency in the form of the war on drugs, the prison economy, which has imprisoned an estimated 13 million Africans in the last few years, all their children, all their families, terrorized by the police, the SWAT teams coming in day after day, no kind of counseling, No question of the mental stability of the U.S. government in perpetrating this violence. You know, the drone strikes, the Afghanistan, and the U.S.-backed war in Congo, where an estimated 6 to 7 million Africans have been killed. I've read that half of that number are children, in Congo. No outcry, no outpouring. And I just think that this is, you know, this is what white people have been complicit with and what the U.S. government has done and is doing to African people, to indigenous people, Arab people, oppressed people around the world for the last 600 years. And imperialism is in a crisis because, like you're saying, that oppressed peoples who were the former, quote, objects of history are standing up and demanding their own vision, their own right to freedom and independence and right to control their own resources and to overturn U.S. imperialism. So white people have a lot of learning to do, a lot of opening up to do about people's children being killed around the world daily for the last 600 years. There's a lot of understanding that has to be, you know, gained by the white population of what everybody else has suffered for what we take for granted. And I think that the African People's Solidarity Committee offers a tremendous opportunity for white people, the only opportunity for white people to gain this recognition and at the same time to have the ability to have a future on this planet. The only future on this planet is on the side of African and oppressed people rising up to overturn the system built on violence.
Uhuru, I think that that the African People's Solidarity Committee has an important role to play in this issue. I think that at some time we have to ask the question of the inability of a social system to do a self-criticism. It seems to be a fundamental problem here that is so deep that the actual killer is apologized for. That all the media, I've seen CNN and this Negro woman, she's not quite Negro. She's a sort of an un-Negro. Her name, the Soledad woman, O'Brien, who we first ran into in the Bay Area, if you will remember. An occasion where an African child, I think a very small child, had gone into a home and injured, beat a baby very badly. And our confrontation with her before she was Soledad at CNN was because she had declared him and other African children predators. So our children are predators. Even this child may have been a preteen who did the offense, certainly not much older than a teenager if he were. And Adam Lanza is a troubled, as they characterize in all of the media, not the so-called right-wing media, the Fox, the liberals are all characterizing this guy's trouble. And it's partially because of a system not being able to do a self-criticism. It will never be able to solve the problem if it were interested in solving the problem with counseling, with the dogs, the issue of movies. They want to act like the movies and TV started when the movies and TV are simply a reflection of the kind of society that we are talking about. It is an inability to do a self-criticism to the point that even when we look at Columbine, they're talking about troubled youth. They got to investigate what was wrong with them. There's never a discussion about what's wrong with an African who would kill somebody or commit an offense that they don't like, which is something that challenges the status quo, or even commit an offense that substantiates their worst views about black people, the crossfires that's happening in a starving community about people fighting over drug turf. That's different from what you will find in Newtown, where, again, it is a wealthy, with an income 74% higher than the most of the cities in the United States, and they apologize for all of them, even Hitler. when they talk about Hitler, they talk about somebody who was deranged. He must have been mad. There's never an investigation of the political questions involved there, and there were political questions that they won't talk about because it's fundamental to the nature of the social system itself. Even John Brown was crazy. So they liquidate all the political discussions because of an inability to do a self-criticism of the society itself. And what are we talking about? We're talking about capitalism, which was born from slavery, which was born from rape and pillage around the rest of the world, the kinds of acts that Kaifeng talked about earlier on in this discussion. The new town is a new town because the old town that existed before has been disappeared by the white people who killed all the indigenous people and took the land and resources that they lived on and built an economy off of African people. So the fact is that we have all of this concern for white people in the United States. You know, we have, because there's no expectation that white people should die like this, one, and two, because white people are human and the rest of us have been dehumanized with the philosophy or the ideology of racism. That's what it is, that denies humanity of the rest of us, and we are only important and significant as it relates to how our existence or lack or non-existence contributes or detracts from the resources and well-being of white people. So I think that's part of what it is that we're looking at. And here we have this Barack Hussein Obama crying crocodile tears on the one hand while being responsible. Barack Obama is the one who gave the command to kill that 17-year-old kid that he characterized as a pirate, a Somali pirate, a country that's been starved, a territory that's been starved because of U.S. corporate intent on stealing the oil that's there and wreaking havoc throughout the continent of Africa. Barack Obama gave the his personal, he had to sign on to that. He signed on to killing that old man in Pakistan, that day, Osama bin Laden. And there's no discussion because he's a dirty Arab, because he is not white. There's no discussion about what legitimate claims that the people who are dying and fighting back there. There's no discussion. Saddam was characterized as this evil person. Libya, the Gaddafi was characterized as something the most dreadful or hated person in the whole world because he's an Arab who's and not white, and they want something there. So nobody's talking about after sending dogs and to cuddle to Libya, where all of these people have been killed most recently, or to the African communities throughout the world, including inside the United States, or to the Mexicans who are wiped out. There are no dogs. There are no counseling things. And if it is true that that this wealthy community in Newtown, Connecticut, needs counseling because of the death of the 28 people there, then what kind of counseling would the whole nation of African people require? What kind of counseling would be required for the people who were being bombed all over the Middle East? What kind of counseling for the people in Palestine, who are constantly under attack by this white nationalist, illegitimate Jewish state that's scarring and destroying the lives and futures of the people there? The problem is capitalism. It is a rotten, foul social system, and it is rotten and foul whether it is has the face of a Barack Hussein Obama or a George Bush or any other force out there in the world. The reality is that we are the only ones with the ability to do a criticism of the society. And it is a capitalist society, which means that it's not just a statement of an historical fact that there are no Indians in Newtown. It is not just a statement of an historical fact that African people were enslaved and kept, and even now locked up in a modern-day slavery within the United States and much of the world. It's not just a statement of an historical fact that the United States continues to this day to be bombing and looting throughout the Middle East. The fact is that the capitalist economy itself is based on that, is born out of that. It is the foundation of capitalism, and then everything else, culturally, the whole superstructure that came out of that, the whole society is permeated with the response to that material reality. The consciousness of white people and other people around the world is a reflection of the society born of rape and pillage and slavery. So yes, you get this thing that's happening in Newtown. Yes, you will get a Columbine and the kind of chaos spread every place that is beginning to approximate. It's beginning to look something like the chaos that the rest of us experience every day. Every African community in the United States, from Houston in Texas to Tampa in Florida, in various places, you find this kind of chaos, but there's not this kind of response. And that's coming from the rest of the country, again, because it's supposed to happen to the rest of us, but it's not supposed to happen to white people. And it is happening to white people, and that is a statement of the growing crisis of imperialism, because there are less victims. There are less people in Venezuela who can be victimized in the same way, and it's harder to victimize people in Afghanistan and every place. And that is having consequences in terms of the economy and in terms of even the vision, the ability for white people to see a future, because the future for the white world has depended on a lack of future for the rest of us. So as we have a growing demonstration of future, then it challenges the future that has been built upon taking our future away from us, and that contributes to the crisis and, I believe, to mental instability. So if there is some craziness there, it is an insanity born of the fact that even though it didn't happen on the 21st of December, even though the Mayans didn't have the date correct according to them, there is a pending demise of a social system of imperialism itself, and that's the statement that has to be made. And if white people want to stop Newtowns and stop Columbines and stop this thing from eating at them, then they have to join the rest of us who are trying to do the same thing and overturn the social system that's sending drones to Afghanistan. Because guess what? What is a drone, they say? It is an unmanned vehicle that's being used to kill people, etc. Well, it looks like the drones are now attacking, you know, in various places throughout the United States, at least in unthinking. Perhaps it is a thinking representative of imperialism. I don't know. It seems to me that gets us closer to understanding the reality of Newtown than what we've been hearing up to now. And the preppers, you know, I think everybody should be storing food and getting guns. Well, not everybody, because most of the people who don't need them already got them. But I do believe that this whole issue of gun control is one that contributes to the real requirement of the capitalist colonial state to have a monopoly on violence, which is why they come to our communities, you know, offering $50 to buy a gun when they should have been in Newtown. Which is why they say Iran can't have atomic weapons and nobody else has the ability to defend themselves from imperialism. Penny Hess, you were going to say something. Uhura.
I was just going to say that following the Newtown situation, African churches all over the country offered gift cards of $200 for every person that would turn in their guns. Because I heard about that in Oakland and also in Brooklyn. It was on the radio. And they're not doing that in the white community. If they had a collection of assault weapons in the white community, you know, it would fill up the entire town, you know, square mileage. I mean, every thousands and millions of white people have major weapons collections as a way of saying that they're going to protect themselves. And a lot of what you're talking about on the preppers, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of the preppers are saying, well, we're going to defend ourselves when the crisis happens, and they're talking about Africans. Yeah. They're going to fight Africans. They're going to fight the Chinese might come, you know, or anything. Like, they're going to protect their little space when this whole world system is being overthrown by African and oppressed people, when capitalism is going to go, you know. Yeah. And it's I mean, I agree that people should be stocking up, but the dreams of white people to protect themselves is really ridiculous. And, you know, I just think this is a profound period that you're talking about, that you've been summing up. The ability to see the world change right before our eyes every day is really powerful. And this is one more symptom of that.
Well, it's not ridiculous in so many ways, because it is the time that is incredible. Because you said something about churches. I don't know how many of the Negro churches were actually involved in that, because part of that may be something that try and kickstart a drive in the African community to give up their guns. But what is surely the case is that white people are buying more guns since Newtown, and people are running out of ammo, you can't find ammo and that kind of stuff since Newtown, with the expectation that the drive now, this upset, is going to have the government get involved in trying to take guns and initiate gun control laws that's going to make it harder to get guns. And the fact is, again, that those of us who, we have a responsibility in this movement to really expose colonialism and capitalism that has visited so much violence and death and terror onto the planet Earth. And also, we have to really criticize the white community, including the community in Newtown, for its willing participation, either actively or passively, in the violence that's been imposed on the rest of the world, and this requirement that everybody else feel sympathetic to what is happening to white people and to them in Newtown. And then, of course, most people do feel sympathy. I mean, the idea that children are being killed like that is incredible. But most people feel that way about what's happening to children in Pakistan and Palestine and the African communities and other places around the world, except those of us who live in these communities who have been so victimized that we've bought into the narrative that has been created for why we suffer the way we do by the ones who create the suffering for us. Some of us actually have come to accept the lie of the oppressor as the truth. As Malcolm X used to say, that they'll have you believing that your friends are your enemies and your enemies are your friends. So Newtown, really not that new in so many ways. We got just a couple more minutes, K-Fing, just a couple more minutes before the next segment of the show. But I know that, though I cannot see you from here, that you're busting at the seams with the need to make some final statements.
Oh, yeah, I do want to make a final comment. And that's on this question of mental illness and the role that the media play. See, because if you look at the photos of the Newtown shooter, the Arizona shooter who shot the congresswoman, and the Colorado shooter, they took enough photos, but every photo they showed of these people had them all buck-eyed and actually looked like they were insane, right? But you can contrast that with the so-called subway shooter, the African who shot the people on the subway and looked the white woman in the eye and said, no, that wasn't me. But now, he was sane enough that he could defend himself in a court of law. But the rest of these people
Colin Ferguson.
Insane. But I think that we really have to look at that. And the other thing is that African collaboration with the bourgeoisie in these times, at least we've identified them for who they are. And I think the revolution was there with their person. This congresswoman here in Houston, Sheila Jackson Lee. Now, see, they have a big press conference and a memorial for, and they lay in wreaths for all of the dead children in Newtown. On one hand, but Africans, the police killed African people in this town, at least once, twice every week.
Yeah.
Not a week passed by. How do you think the white population in Newtown would react to an APSC presence coming there with these politics that you are putting forth? You think we would see a lynch mob?
Well, I think we need to.
Even though it's true.
We need to be everywhere. I think it. I don't know. You know, people are looking for answers.
Are they really? But I think that you know. I mean, you look at just what Wilson Good dropped a bomb on Philadelphia. How many crying people in Philadelphia? How many crying people from any place else? 11 children, women, and men killed. People still in prison as a consequence of that process. Families, this community wiped out, 60-some-odd houses burned to the ground, et cetera. No tears, not even an expectation of a tear. And even in Philadelphia itself, where it happened. So Newtown, not that new, and we're going to be looking at more and more Newtowns, I suspect. Some of it will be self-inflicted. Some of it, as the movement struggle grows and develops in this country, may not be self-inflicted, but certainly the casualties will continue to mount as long as imperialism continues to exist. So I want to thank the two of you for participating in this incredibly important discussion. I know, as I said, it's going to be an ongoing discussion, but at least I believe we had an opportunity to bring some important insights. This is Africa Live. You've been listening to Omali Shetela, along with Penny Hess, Omawale K. Fing, discussing Newtown. In the next segment, we are going to look at how banks have been involved in drug pushing and the development of capitalism and our oppression over the last few hundred years. Stay tuned.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
He has been the message of baptism and reparation to the white community.
Don't miss keynote speakers Chairman Omali Shetela and APSC Chairwoman Penny Hess at African Resistance White Solidarity, the International Conference of the African People's Solidarity Committee, on January 6th through the 8th, 2013, in St. Petersburg, Florida. Register today at apscuhuru.org.
Are you tired of too many reruns on Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
You're listening to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com.
also speak of a people in love with unity. And just how can this be that 1963 seems much better?
Uhuru brothers and sisters, comrades, you're back with Africa Live on Uhuru News, your revolutionary radio station. I'm Omali Ishatela. I'm hosting this show on today. As you know, the first segment of the show dealt with the Newtown massacre, which is something that is taking up a lot of media space within the United States and I guess to some extent throughout the world, as people are unaccustomed to mass deaths, violent deaths here in the United States in white communities. So we talked about that. And this segment, we have another discussion, I believe, that stems from the same kind of contradictions that gave rise to the Newtown massacre. This has to do with the recent revelations settlement that was made around what they characterize as drug money laundering by HSBC, a massive bank that was involved, it has been exposed in billions of dollars, billions of dollars in what they characterize as drug laundering. At first glance, it seems to be a relatively simple case for those of us who are familiar with stories about drug dealing and money laundering within the United States, which is a recurrent theme in most of the media here. But looking a bit deeper than what the government and media have given to us, we discovered that this is an issue of much greater significance than we would be led to believe. It is interesting that the question of HSBC and which was the indicted, I guess there was an indictment involved, bank in this case. Well, no indictment, just a charge, $1.9 billion fine. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody's picture's in the paper. Nobody's named at all. But we dig into it, and we find that there's a greater, much more important and significant history here to this bank. But also, I think it goes to the whole issue of the rise of capitalism as a social system itself, a system that was born out of historical fecal matter, if you will, just an incredible scar on humanity, capitalism, and we're going to talk about that. We have with us in the studio Chairwoman Penny Hess from the African People's Solidarity Committee by phone in Houston, Texas, Omawale K. Fing, who is a member of the African People's Socialist Party, former member of the Central Committee and editor of the Burning Spear, and also by phone in the San Francisco, California, Bay Area, David Reardon. Long time, almost, well, certainly more than 30-year member of the Uhuru movement, somebody who spent perhaps most of his life investigating and bringing analysis to this world, digging in deeper, more deeply than what the system would have us to believe. And Redbeard is somebody, that's how we've known him for many years, who has a take on this question of the banks that we think is really important, and we've invited him to participate in this discussion as well. I'd like to open up with Comrade Penny Hess. Perhaps you can give us some of the history of this issue that we're dealing with, especially as it relates to HSBC, but But the drug industry and its relationship to the financial institutions, and perhaps what you know about HSBC. Uhuru.
Uhuru, Chairman, thank you. It's an honor to be on this show, and I want to say uhuru to Dave Reardon out in San Francisco, uhuru, and uhuru to Omawali K. Fing. And this is a really, you know, every time we delve into this question of the capitalist drug trade, it's just always mind-boggling, the depth and the vastness of this question, and it's something that we could have many, many, many shows on. And I know that recently was an article on Uhuru News, or it's up there now, and, you know, I appreciate the input that Omawali K. Fing and Dave Reardon have put into that, and just want to say a few things quickly, because the chairman talks about primitive accumulation of capital, and he shows Marx's theory, Marx's quote in part 8 of his book, The Capital, that says that capitalism was born from the turning of Africa into the commercial warren for the commercial selling of African skins, he says, and the turning of the Americas, you know, putting the indigenous people into the mines that bring out silver and the gold for the wealth of Europe. And he also mentions very lightly the opium wars by the British against China. And, you know, when we look at the vast wealth created by all of this, it is so deep. And just to mention that, almost coinciding with the exposure of this particular bank was the eulogy that Obama gave to Senator Inouye, who did, I read a really good article exposing the depth to which Inouye covered over the Iran-Contra and the U.S. involvement in it, and, you know, what he could have done, and he was well paid for covering that reality over. But just to go back to a little bit of history, the British East India Company was the British colonial corporation that set out to conquer and colonize Asia at the same time that the British West India Company was coordinating the trade in African people from Africa to the Caribbean. And this was the company that introduced opium as a commodity, because it had been used in many countries around the world for millennia as medicine and for that kind of thing. And the British began growing opium poppies in 1773 in India, which was already their colony, was colonized by Britain. And they began to grow and produce opium and established a monopoly of opium and the opium trade. And they began pushing it on China as a way of saying that we want you to take this opium and we want your silk, your porcelain, your tea, and all this kind of thing. And there was a huge resistance from China for that. And ultimately, as the chairman said, the British forced the whole country of China to become junkies, practically. In fact, there were 17 million deaths from the opium trade, and it is estimated that by the year 1900, 13.5 million Chinese people were opium addicts, because the British East India Company actually had, of course, an army component, military component, that would come into China and literally put guns to people's heads to say, smoke this opium. They were forced to do it. It was highly addictive. And China resisted and said, no, we're making opium illegal. And basically, Britain attacked them twice in the 1840s, which at that point, China lost because of, in part, the huge percentage of their military was addicted to opium at that point. This is how vast it was. And it wasn't until 1900 in what is called you know, I feel very facetiously called the Boxer Rebellion, which in fact was a huge mass uprising of the Chinese people that led the way to Mao's movement that eventually overturned the neocolonial government, that could overturn this question of this oppression through the vast opium addiction forced on the people of China. But the HSBC Bank was the bank created by the British East India Company in 1865 after the Opium War, where finally the British forced the Chinese to allow them, you know, they had to, they were forced to let the British dump tons and tons of opium into China. And so the H stands for, as Kay Feng had pointed out, Hong Kong, which is the British drug colony and, you know, was for many, many years, and Shanghai, which was the center of the Chinese opium trade itself. So it was the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation or company. And, you know, just to go on and touch about things that the chairman has talked about many times and our movement has, this whole question of the control of the international drug trade is something that the U.S. and imperialism has maintained. People, they have fought wars over it, and the U.S. struggles, and at this point most probably is the world control of the drug trade. You can look at the fact that all the pharmaceuticals from Merck to Bayer, Park Davis, they began with selling opium and cocaine in their products. This is how they began. They were part of this drug trade. And you can look at the whole question of Vietnam, which was a drug colony for 100 years, forcing the people into addiction there as well. This is what created the wealth of France today. It was a French colony. You can go through the Iran-Contra. You can look at the U.S.'s control of Colombia, the Golden Triangle, which is the U.S. created the Hmong, used that as a neocolonial grouping, family grouping in that area, and created an army of 30,000 to as basically you know, a anti-revolutionary army attacking Vietnam at that time. There is an estimated the relationship of the U.S. in this, what they call the Mexico drug war, which is you know, Eric Holder involved, the so-called DEA, all of this arming certain facets or sending arms into there, an estimated 200,000 people killed in Mexico. Nobody talks about that. The drug war inside the United States that the U.S. clearly funds, arms, it's been exposed. You know, Gary Webb and even the Iran-Contra hearings to a certain extent show the extent that the CIA and the U.S. government planted the drugs, and the banking system is the way that these this money is, that's how it's handled, and it always has been from the very beginning, and it's not new. And the fact that HSBC Bank has been exposed now is nothing new, because almost every single year Bank of America pays a similar fine. Wachovia just paid earlier this year, paid a fine for the same thing, and Wachovia is Wells Fargo, and it's actually also has connections to HSBC Bank. So, you know, the CIA connection, there's just volumes written about this and exposed, but when we look at the amount of wealth based on the U.S. and imperialist control and forcing drug addiction and the destabilization of colonial societies through the drug trade, it is clearly primitive accumulation of capital. It is one of the rungs of the foundations of capitalism, as you have talked about, Chairman.
Uhuru, you're listening to Africa Live. That was Penny Hess, who was speaking. She is chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee. I have on the on the phone in Houston, Texas, Omawale K. Fing, in San Francisco, David Reardon. We're talking here about the question of the so-called exposure of HSBC, one of the major banks of the world, in what they've characterized as drug laundering. We've noticed that after having been exposed for their role in drug laundering, that they were only asked to pay a fine, that there was no charges filed against anybody. Nobody's picture was in the paper. Nobody went to jail. And the U.S. government defended the decision not to prosecute the bank for accepting the money, saying that it was preferable to let them go free to what they characterize as the collateral consequences of taking the bank to court. They said that how taking the bank to court, we have another instance of something too big to fail, would result in destabilization of the entire banking system, which is a profound statement, I would think. Hopefully there are people out there who want to join this discussion. If you do, within the United States, the phone number is 727-565-1599. In the United Kingdom, the number is 440-208-133-6629. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio. That's U-H-U-R-U Radio. You can email to join this discussion at dj@uhururadio.com. So, Dave, you've heard this discussion. There's a lot of money, obviously, involved in this relationship that the banks have to drug laundering. And you remember, David, for years in Oakland, we raised the slogan that presaged the fellow who would write the book on this, the David, the Webb, Gary Webb's book. You know, we had a movement saying that the White House is the rock house and Uncle Sam is the pusher man. We've talked about the drug economy as opposed to how people would impose this idea of some kind of drug problems in our community. We're saying you're looking at a drug economy, not a drug problem. And I think that much of what you've been looking at recently is just reaffirmed what we've been saying for years.
Yes. Uhuru to everyone. And I do remember the White House is the rock house and the Uncle Sam is the pusher man. And again, thank you for this opportunity. I want to say that my thinking has been influenced by the party and the Uhuru movement since at least 1978. So the banking system, too big to fail, I think we're in the stage of monopoly capitalism right now, and the banks represent finance capital. And the function of the bank then is to collect deposits, accumulate capital, which it does. And then specifically, the function of cash in the banking system, I think, is important because when we talk about the banks failing, being too big to fail, it I'm trying to get my head around it, but we know that the primitive accumulation of capital came from the colonies and slave trade, and that the system rests on the economic pedestal of colonialism. And the system itself is some kind of a Ponzi scheme that I can't quite grasp, all this trading of complex financial instruments. But cash, and we know that the drug trade is a multi-billion dollar international cash business. In the United States, it represented in 2003 about $321 billion in cash. And now, according to Wikipedia, the amount of outstanding cash is about $700 billion in outstanding cash. That is to say, it's not in banks. And about half of that seems to represent the drug trade. Now, the bank, to remain solvent, has to have assets, real assets, not paper credits and complex financial instruments or toxic assets. It has to have real assets. And the value of real assets, such as a home or a piece of land or a stock, it's a relative value. Cash, on the other hand, has a definite face value. A dollar is a dollar. What you can buy with that dollar might diminish, but the dollar is still a dollar. And one of the three main functions of currency is it's a store of value. You accumulate value in your life through work or whatever, and it's stored in the currency. Now, for the banks to remain solvent, there's something called the reserve ratio. They have to have a certain amount of real assets on their books to balance the amount of money or assets they loan or they speculate with. And cash is a real asset. That's why so-called money laundering is so essential to these big banks. They have to have the cash to stabilize that reserve ratio. Because the rest of the stuff, most of the rest of the economy, for example, our paychecks, when we buy something by credit card, it's all on paper, it's all electronic. And then these financial instruments, they may be real, they may not be real. We don't know. But cash, we know, like cash, land, physical asset, it's a physical asset. The importance, from my point of view, the importance of the African community and the colonized community to this relationship is really significant. I mean, we know that drugs are used as chemical warfare, but also Africans are used as consumers of drugs.
That's right.
And they're used as unpaid drug workers who have no unions. They don't have any benefits. They're just workers out there. The drug trade doesn't pay taxes. It's completely privatized. And so it's the drug trade beyond chemical warfare, economically speaking, is really significant to the capitalist system. There's an international aspect to the drug trade, economically speaking, because the dollar is used as the reserve currency. About 69% of other nations' foreign reserves are held in the dollar. And so the ability of the U.S. government and the finance capitalists to have actual dollars, that is to say truckloads of paper dollars, not electronic credits, it's really important to maintain the position of the dollar as the international currency, because it has to be liquid. And liquidity means that you can take an asset and exchange it for something immediately or very soon, and no one's going to doubt it. And that's what cash does. The system, so-called capitalist system, is based to some degree on trust and honesty of the players and the rule of law. And as Penny and Kay Fing have said about SBC, and it also Deutsche Bank was just busted recently for money laundering. And Deutsche Bank is the number one bank in the world in terms of assets. SBC is, I think, number three. So all the top banks are into money laundering. And it's because they're outlaws, they're rogues, and as the system decays, people want real assets, and the dollar is a real asset. So I hope I'm being coherent here. I want to also just mention that in that the current dynamic, capitalism versus the ever-emerging forces of socialism. And Nkrumah said neocolonialism was the last stage of imperialism. And it's being upheld by Eric Holder, who is letting these big banks commit these crimes. So I think that's mostly what I have to contribute. As I said, thank you for the opportunity. I hope I haven't been too disorganized.
That's splendid, Redbeard, because part of what you've just said is that it is absolutely insane recognizing the role that the drug dollar plays in the economy, especially when you look at the United States, where you're talking about an economy that's based 70% at least on consumer spending, to think that you could have an industry playing such a role in the international economy as drugs, and the United States would not be involved in protecting, preserving, controlling that industry. It would be insane to assume that that would be the case. And I wonder, though, if you could call banks like that rogues, really, since they seem to be the norm and since they were founded, you know, in this whole process of the development of capitalism itself. But I do think that was a really important contribution that you've just made up to now. And but I think that, Kayfing, what do you think? You have anything to say? I mean, we're listening to this. We see that there are billions and billions and billions of dollars that these banks are involved in. And you talk about HSBC's has $173 billion in shares on the stock market. It has assets of $2.6 trillion, no fines, well, a fine of $1.6 billion, if you want to call that a fine, no jail sentences, nothing. And these, I think, is really important for us to remember with the kind of social system that we are dealing with. It's banks like this that actually fund the politicians throughout this country, including the president, and fund the congresspersons. They purchase these guys. They set the norm, if you will, for behavior, legal and behavior for the rest of us, yet they are above the law themselves. Kayfing, do you have any observations that you wanted to make about this?
Observation. The rule of red is good to hear from
you. Word to you, Kayfing.
Listen, I think that we're going to have to do a little more of investigating concerning this drug group laundering money thing as the only role that these banks play. I think you just mentioned, Kevin, about owning and controlling these resources of being productive. Yes, I think when we dig deep, we will find out that that Mr. Banks, who control the cocaine fields down in Colombia, that's controlled by, that's protected by the military down there, U.S. CIA and U.S. military forces, you know, the poppy fields that are in Afghanistan, and I just reading somewhere recently that the number one crash crop in California was marijuana. So who owns these places, these things? Do the banks actually own them, or are we saying that they just laundered the money? I was reading a thing, and I think maybe prior to the paper, so Houston Chronicle, and it's talking about this big time, the headline read, police held back 26 suspects in global drug gang. And they said this gang was accused of laundering at least $70 million this year, started to see it. And then they go on to say that this is one of the biggest drug trafficking hits in recent years. And then it says, quote, the couriers were being transported in suitcases to secret compartments. Now, that's true on the one hand, but now on the other hand, we looked at some stuff. This was back in 2006 with Bartolio Bank and Wells Fargo Bank, where these guys were by the shipload, by the by the tens of hundreds of tons load of cocaine and other illicit drugs were tied to Wells Fargo and Wachivia to the tune of a few years, $378 billion cash by Tobio and Wells Fargo was accused of so-called laundering. Now, out of that, Wells Fargo was supposed to have paid $110 million in forfeiture, whatever that means, a $50 fine. Repeat, I think that's probably the taxes that they pay for that for that criminal activity. But you know what we see is that these 26 people who were arrested for this big time global money laundering of $7 million were in the Dominican Republic. But none of these bankers tied with Machovia, HSBC, or Wells Fargo, like Chairman said, even got that mug in the papers on the way in. Look at the drugs that we know supplied to the Crips and Bloods out in out of California and across this country, where you got a rotating dough to the penitentiary where millions and millions of Africans have been locked down, which they feed another part of the capitalist industry, which is the private prison industry, where folks like organizations like the Corrections Corporation of America make millions of dollars, and who's got contracts right now for building more and more and more prisons, to the extent that government entities even guaranteeing them 90% occupancy. So this thing trickles down throughout U.S. economy, and for sure it plays an intricate role in the prison system. So, again, I think when we do the research, and then listen, there's a ranch down here in Texas they call King's Ranch. And I would imagine it might be the size of Florida or something. Anyway, the police can't even go in that ranch. Don't nobody know. And there's about 56 counties, I think, in Redfield. Don't nobody know what they do there. You know, so, you know, I'm not no conspiracy theorist guy, but I certainly like to know what they grow on that ranch. You know, does all the illegal drugs come from Colombia, South America, Afghanistan, Vietnam, or are they being produced right here? And who are the real owners? Do the banks do more than just plunder money?
Uhuru, well, go ahead, Penny. You're going to say something on
that. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that it's the whole, there's a huge interlocking economic relationship between the banks, the CIA, the military, the DEA, the Department of Justice, the stock market, the police departments, the prison industry. I mean, it's all interrelated. You can make a huge graph of all these things. And, you know, you can look at where the wars are. I mean, opium only grows between Turkey, in that strip, Turkey, Afghanistan to Pakistan, or in Southeast Asia. Well, where is the U.S. been at war for the, you know, last 100 years? And cocaine in South America. I mean, it's all intertwined, and the banks play a key role in that.
So, Kaifeng, you're saying that you don't think that an economic component of such significance to the financial institutions would be left to chance. You don't think that the banks are really gamblers who say, well, I hope somebody's doing some opium so that we can make some money. But there's a great likelihood that a dependency on that kind of resources would have their hands much more involved than simply laundering the money, but making sure that the money gets there for it to be laundered.
Because they would not let those officers in Kuwait be in the hands of the emitters.
Yeah. Listen, but I'm going to ask this to all of you, because we've been hearing lately during this crisis of imperialism, the economic component of it that's beginning to bite in the capitalist centers, United States, Europe, and what have you, that the problem really is not capitalism, but the problem is a sort of bad capitalism that that has been imposed on the world today. That it's not like that good capitalism. It's greed and other things that have become the norm. But from what you're saying, going all the way back to the very inception, to the very founding, to the process that gave birth to capitalism itself, certainly according to Marx, it sort of challenges this notion that there was a good capitalism at once upon a time that treated everybody well, and now it's a problem that it's become a bad capitalism. You got any observations, any of you, Redbeard? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that capitalism is parasitic and has always been parasitic, so it can only be good for the parasite. And I don't see that there's any dispute there.
So the issue then is the reason that there's become a bad capitalism is because there's some self-devouring going on, sort of like Newtown, right? It seems to be impacting with the economy and other questions right here in the centers of capitalism, where people have come to love and benefit from capitalism, that it's no longer a good capitalism, but it's a bad capitalism that's been imposed on them.
Well, I don't quite see it that way. Mm-hmm. I think that the body that the parasite is feeding on is resisting in a variety of ways. And maybe it would be a stretch to say these people who go out and shoot kindergarten kids are reacting to the parasite of capitalism. I don't know, but I mean, the basic relationship, either the host is going to destroy the parasite or the parasite destroys the host. And I think that's what you've been saying for quite some time about the resistance of colonized people to the system. And I think that there is a resistance of white people to the system. I certainly resist to some minute degree to the system. And I'm not a special person. I'm just another bus driver. And people are resisting the system. I think the system is decaying. It's coming to an end. I mean, not gracefully, of course. It's coming to an end because of the dialectic and the struggle, the ever-emerging forces of socialism, as you so succinctly pointed out.
Kaifeng?
Yes.
We got a case of bad capitalism that has descended upon us now.
Well, I think that gentlemen, you're right, and you've answered that question in terms of ex slave, whether or not capitalism was progressive. Millions and millions of Chinese people were put in their graves because of expanding capitalism and imperialism. Yes, that was aggressive. Actually, millions of people who died trying to liberate Vietnam, where the capitalism was progressive. And I think that even the so-called progressives who at once proclaimed themselves to be socialists and then turned right around and said, we're not socialists anymore because socialism has failed as opposed to having ever actually been real socialists and revolutionaries because if that was the case, it would be easy to determine. No, socialism hasn't failed, but it is capitalism that has failed for the vast majority of the people on the planet. And I think that this is the way that we have to raise the question in terms of the bad capitalism and the good capitalism. You know, it is from the perspective of the slave and the colonial people There's never been a good capitalism. We've got the bird, the dead, not just the bird and the dead, but we've got the proxy wars that are going on in Africa right now throughout the country to prove that there's never been a progressive capitalism. Just not turning bad, you know. We just didn't have a relationship to be in lockdown in this country for 400 years. They did it legally on the plantation. Now they just flipped the script and put us in the penitentiary. So no, never a progressive capitalism. In terms of it turning bad, it's always been bad in the eyes of the slave.
Hmm. Chairman?
Yes, Comrade.
I have a question.
Yes.
In 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement was kind of the first international monetary agreement among nation states, and they and all the participating nation states pegged their currency to the dollar, and this was a huge advantage to the U.S. dollar and to U.S. economy. And then in 1971, an event called the Nixon shock, Bretton Woods was dissolved, and so then the currencies were free floating. So there have been challenges to U.S. the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. Currently, the Chinese are challenging it through the International Monetary Fund. And the Iranians have challenged it by trading oil in currencies other than the dollar, and the euro to some degree is a challenge to the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So my question for you and the other participants is, when we talk about capitalism, are we only talking about Euro-American, the Euro-American phenomena that began in 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, or is this, are we seeing the end of capitalism, or can capitalism morph into something where the U.S. plays a subordinate role?
Uhuru, I don't think, I think what we're looking at right now is a changing world. That imperialism is changing its complexion, is changing how it's going to look. When you talk about Bretton Woods and the currency there, you're talking about the nation states. 1944, you're talking about vast majority of the world was still under colonial domination, so no non-participation in that discussion. In it. And the Bretton Woods, as you know, Bretton Woods determinations just simply had to do with how a world economic system was going to look that rested on colonialism and a certain form of enslavement from the by people who were outside of Europe. I think that you know that there's a major change that has been taken on. You mentioned 1492 to 1492 process beginning. And I think with by the time of capitalism itself, we're looking at, of course, the end of feudalism and a social system still based on exploitation, however, emerging. An explanation having to be given for this kind of social system that was emerging. When you talk about 1492, of course, you're talking about the process that began the enslavement and domination of the rest of the world by Europe. That process gave rise ultimately to what we know as capitalism, which emerged full-blown in the 19th century with the undermining destruction of feudalism, sometimes through war, most times through some violent revolutionary kind of activity where capitalism rose full-bloom. I think it's really important to remember, however, that you know, you're talking about even that process of colonialism that gave rise to capitalism was the a beginning of Europe dominating the rest of the world. That's how white people came to what we now know as America, throughout North America, Australia, all these other different places. And so we have capitalism coming, which now is a system based on certain kinds of dynamics having to do with commodity production, wage labor, which required in many ways the end of the slavery of African people and private, you know, monopoly of the means of production. And Marx, one of the things about Marx and others, not just Marx and Engels, but an explanation for this reality gave rise to what we now know as Marxism and most of the what we accept as the definition of socialism came from that process, challenging capitalism, how it should function, etc. But the a major weakness in all of that was this inability to recognize the role of parasitism. It did not recognize that. So even as we talk about Marx, who wrote this wonderful book, Capital, and spent something like 17 years working on that book, living in poverty, his children dying while he worked on the book, but he was supported primarily by Engels, Frederick Engels. And Engels, of course, was from the bourgeoisie. His father was a textile owner, and he took money from his father to support Marx and his family. But where does Engels' money come from? Engels' money came from the slave trade, from cotton. It was cotton textiles. So during an era of slavery, Marx writes about capital and its significance, etc., being funded by slavery itself. Slavery funded that entire process. But you don't hear Marx, who is astute enough to say that what he referred to as a profound contradiction of capitalism being wage slavery in Europe resting on a pedestal of slavery pure and simple in the so-called New World. And he said that this is the fundamental question. This is the equivalent in political economy of original sin in theology. But his work is not based on that. His work is based on some assumption of this contradiction that exists between industrial workers and the industrial bourgeoisie. So over a period of time, you've had this capitalism resting uneasily on colonialism, on slavery. And over a period of time, people have been wresting ourselves free from that and overturning that system. And what has happened is created a tremendous amount of anxiety almost every time. It's not just anxiety of the bourgeoisie. It permeates the entire society. That's why I will attach what happened in Newtown to the crisis of imperialism because it creates anxiety and, I believe, mental illnesses and all other kinds of things because the world as we knew it is in a tremendous state of transformation. What is the world going to look like? That's not an easy or simple matter for, you know, people not knowing what the world is going to look like. It's the is the world flat? Will I sail off the planet, you know, off the earth when I go beyond the horizon? That's a fundamental, frightening question. Will when the sun goes down tonight, will it come back up tomorrow? Those are questions that humanity, you know, have had to deal with for a long period of time, and I think that it impacts on the consciousness, the morale of whole societies and whole populations. So if you got one sector of the world who really requires this relationship for their happiness, there's one sector of the world that requires for their happiness for the world to be as it is, you know, with half the people living off $2.50 a day, 80% living off $10, they require that for their happiness. That's what brought them happiness. That's what brought them every vision of a wonderful future for tomorrow, this kind of world. And what is clear before everybody, this world is changing. It's changing because of resistance everywhere. It's changing demographically because white people are disappearing as majority people in certain sectors like this country, and even in Europe, it's problematic. So I'm saying that there are psychological, emotional,
all kinds of contradictions that go along with the kind of society that we live in. And the other thing that's happening is a whole philosophy was born in this process that we call racism, and the whole ideology that justifies this. And now you got China and India contending with this European, Euro-America domination in the world. And I do believe that what we're seeing is imperialism clearly in a state of crisis. And part of the crisis of imperialism as it exists is not only the resistance that we see in Asia and throughout the Americas and other places, but part of the crisis of imperialism as it exists, because it exists as white power, is the emergence of contenders like China and India and et cetera. And yes, I do believe that we're in the process now of seeing capitalism change in terms of its complexion, how it looks, etc. And the question before us, I believe, is whether genuine revolutionaries who must recognize capitalism as parasitic. They can't go, if you can't do that in Connecticut and Greece and all these other places where we see certain representatives of crisis, then we can't take advantage of this wonderful historical moment. And we may find ourselves living with a Chinese-dominated capitalist world or some other things like that. Of course, the people in China, I'm sure peasants and workers got something to say about that as well. So I'm not assuming that this is a future that's going to be determined by everybody, you know, externally. I think that there are roles for all of us to play, but I think it's incredibly important right now to recognize the very nature of the social system as parasitic, which is more than just a word, just a term, but the very essence of the society itself. And to be, you know, white who is in contention with the system as it exists is not necessarily be in contention with parasitic capitalism. It's, yes, I'm trying, you know, they're taking away my student loans. They take the whatever you call it, that when you have to go to college, it costs tuitions too much. I'm losing my pensions, et cetera. So I'm fighting. But if people are not conscious they're fighting as parasitic capitalism, they can actually be fighting to preserve the very same system that they're talking about they're opposed to. They can be fighting to keep the world as it is, which is a world that provides for the white people of the world all these goodies at the expense of everybody else. So, yeah, capitalism is changing. It is changing. It is in a state of crisis, and part of the crisis is the change that it's undergoing now. But, you know, the labor pangs, you know, like in a woman is a state of crisis, something's got to give, you know, because, you know, once you get beyond that nine-month period, you know, something's got to give. And I think capitalism is experiencing that kind of crisis, and it's up to us to determine what the outcome is going to be. That is
so
not,
you're saying that socialism is not guaranteed out of this crisis?
No, socialism is not guaranteed out of this crisis. No, it is not guaranteed. And that's one of the things I think is really important for us to say. It is not guaranteed. We, I believe, are the ones who are going to have to make that determination of what the outcome is going to be. I think that's our task, our responsibilities. And I, you know, I'm excited about our possibilities, to tell you the truth. I'm really, this is...
You've always been excited.
but to be meaningfully excited at 71, Redbeard, is different. So,
Uhuru,
comrades. So, we just got a couple of minutes left, and K-Fing, I do mean a couple of minutes. How many minutes we got left? We got 2 minutes left. So, K-Fing, you only got 15 seconds.
I just want to make two comments. One is that I appreciate Red Beard's input on this discussion. And it kind of gives me an idea of why the government, in terms of the federal cash money, why the government is choosing to make everybody have an electronic deposit as opposed to having the cash anymore. And the other thing is Penny Hens, I really appreciate your response to the question on the first half of the program when I asked you about APSC being in Newtown, and your response was